have a 10-minute talk and so decided one which is nice and easy to listen to and generally enjoyable. So this is a talk about the 10 ox herding pictures, and it is found in the Zen tradition. And it's 10 images. I have them here, but later, at the end of the talk, I will put them up so you can all see them. And so basically, is a meditative path in pictures. And this came in China. And so first there was a series of poems, and then with the poems, there was a series of pictures. And basically, it's a story. It's a story of a ox. An ox is like a cow. So you can call, sometimes it say it's a bull, sometimes a cow, sometimes an ox. So basically, it's a cow. Let's say it will be easier for everybody. So you have a cow, and then you have the cow herder. You have the little guy who is kind of, you know, trying to keep the cow. And that's a story. And so, and in a way, this was created to describe the path, the meditative path in picture. And so the way it's done is that there is a title. Each of the picture, I have a title. So I won't go into the poem that you can always find on the internet, but I'll just look at the title, the picture, and then I'll see it in terms of our practice here in our life. So the first picture, in a way, set the its beginning of the scene, of the story. And in it, you just have like forest. You know, it's like a Zen painting, so it's just a few marks. So you have kind of just, you know, like it looks like there is a little river, little bushes, and there is a cow herder. The little boy who keeps the cow is looking for the cow. And that's why the picture is called searching for the cow. And so he's kind of looking, because it could be here, it could be there. And so it's kind of like the first picture is very much of looking for something. And to me, is to see that some point in our life, we suddenly feel that something is missing. And so all we kind of want to look beyond our limits. There is maybe some tension, some suffering. We might be looking for some ease, some peace. And so we kind of look here and there, trying to maybe find something in the material world, or maybe find something in the emotional world or outside. And so in a way, we try to find something. We kind of think, where is it? We try to look for something. Until maybe we might realize that we can only find it within ourselves. And this show to me a little is like each of us is how we started. Each we started before we started to meditate by looking for something, wondering about something. And we can start at any age. I mean, I started when I was 18, but one of my greatest friends started when she was 57. 57, she came from a really good family in Switzerland. And suddenly she decided, I want to do meditation. I want to learn Buddhism. And she went to India, to Dharamsala, where the Dalai Lama is, and she became a nun. And I thought it was wonderful. But what was even more wonderful with her is that she was a nun for many years, and then when she was 75, she came to me and Stephen, and she said, I have a big decision to make, and I want your advice. I want to stop to be a nun, to live a more creative life. And we were so traditional. Stephen and I said, no, stay a nun, you're such a good example, everything. And very rightly, she did not listen to us. And she stopped being a nun, and she continued to be a wonderful person. But I thought it was so great that age 57, she found meditation, and then age 75, she decided to stop being a nun. I thought it really showed that the spirit, that the potential can always be creative, can always flow and move on. Then you have the next picture. And in the next picture, it's called seeing the footprint. So the little boy, the cowherder, comes on the road and he sees footprint. You know, like there is prints. And he sees, it looks like the prints of a cow. Doesn't look like the print of an elephant. So he's on the right track. And I think this, for ourselves, is when we start to think, to realize that maybe what is missing, we cannot find so much outside, but we have to find inside, and maybe we can find it in the meditative path, in the spiritual path, is that we see it's not just in acquiring things, but maybe we can find it in a different way, being a different way. And so in a way, it's kind of finding traces, finding ideas, maybe finding, you know, books or poetry. And I know for myself that when I started to feel, because before I was interested in meditation, I wanted to change the world, and I was an anarchist. I was very much into politics. And then I decided maybe before changing the world, I should change myself. So I kind of went more like the meditative path. And at that time, I started, you know, this was in the 70s, so there was not as much books and poetry as now. But whenever I heard certain poems, like Chinese poem, I would hear, the great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. And I used to think, this is really good. Oh, I like this. Or in other poems, which was, when the birds fly through the sky, they leave no traces. When the shadow of the bamboo sweeps the steps, they leave no traces. And I used to think, ooh, this is, yes, yes, you know, I want this, you know, this is great, I like it. And then the question is about the footprint. Are they old or new? Are they relevant or not? Can we apply them or not? And so this is, in a way, we find these traces which seems to inspire us, and then we wonder. And this is an experience I had when I was in my 20s, early 20s. And I found Krishnamurti. In the 70s, Krishnamurti was very, very big, very major. And Krishnamurti used to be about awareness. You must be aware. So I decided I was going to do what Krishnamurti said. So I took a blanket, and I was in the Alps. So I went to the mountain with the idea that for 3 days I would fast so that I would not have to worry about food. And then I would do what he said. So I took the book with me to the mountain with the blanket. So I found a beautiful meadow, lots of beautiful flowers, and there was this huge sky. And I sat in the middle of the meadow. I would look at the book. He said, be aware. And I would, be aware. Then I would look at the book, be aware, be aware. And I did this for a day and a half, and it did not work whatsoever. So I thought, forget this. This is not for me. So I went down the mountain. So obviously, we have to see how the traces are. Do they say something? Are they meaningful? Can we apply them? Then you have the next picture, which is a lovely picture. You have like a bush, like a kind of a, like a little kind of a tree. And then in the middle of the tree, because it's called seeing the cow's tail. So you see the bottom of the ox and the tail which flicks. So then, but you see it, you don't see it. So in a way, now the little cow herder know it exists. There is a cow, it is there. And to me, this is when we try to go beyond words and we try to practice and we encounter different path and method. And I know for my, and then you have to see, does it fit? Does it inspire me? Is it meaningful? Is it beneficial? Because when I was 18 to 21, I tried different things. The first thing I tried was weird things I did. I was working in the day in England, in London, and every evening I went with a group of 20 people in a basement, and we used to hyperventilate naked. And we did it for a week every night. And I must say, at the end, I was not convinced. So they wanted me to do another course, another week. I said, no, I have enough of that. Did not do what I wanted to do. Like you, and you do an hour of this, naked. Don't know what the naked was about. But. So I did that. Then I tried another one, which was interesting, was Taoism by correspondence. So, I don't know who told me to do that. So I would, wrote my subscription to the course, and then I would get a little, once a month, a little practice. But the first one did not really work for me, because I was told to lie down on the bed, and then to imagine that my spirit was going into the corner of the ceiling. And I tried it for a month and nothing happened. So I gave up Taoism by correspondence. And so, in a way, even if we find Buddhism, you can have, you have one tradition, and even within it, you have many paths. I know I met, Tibetan Buddhism, and again, there was no connection. Then I went to the Theravada countries and I met Theravada Buddhism and I thought, I'm not so sure about that one. And then I ended up in Korea and then it seems to fit. And this takes me to the fourth picture, which is called catching the ox. So there you have the ox herder finally has caught the ox with a rope. And so he's holding onto the rope. But the cow doesn't want to be caught, so it's kind of like. And to me, this picture is the most energetic, is the one who requires, in a way, the most effort. And it's a picture because finally we decide to do it. We decide to do the meditation practice, we decide to cultivate what we have heard about, read in books, chosen to do. And possibly this is what you have experienced during this week, and some of you might have experienced when you started your first retreat, is that between the idea of doing a retreat, won't it be nice to do a retreat, I do meditation, I learn this and that, to actually sitting in meditation, walking in meditation, trying to keep the silence, it is not easy. Because the whole body and mind is not used to that. So it's really kind of like nearly like this struggle. For me, this picture is very much at the beginning the struggle with the practice, the struggle with really organically trying to do it. And as an abstract idea, meditation is very easy. And often we think meditation, you have picture of people sitting, looking wonderfully relaxed. But when you sit in meditation, you find actually that it's really hard work just to hold the body, just to try to be present. And in Korea, one thing that our teacher always asked us is, are you working hard? And we used to say, yes, 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 we are working hard. So it's really straight away told you, this is not like just, a little walk in the woods. You really had to bring your whole body and mind to it. And because we're not used to it, I think this is the main thing, we're not used to sit still. I mean, think of yourself in front of the TV. I mean, you do the same. When you watch TV or when you sit in meditation, it's very similar in a way. Apart that when you watch TV, it's outer television. When you sit in meditation, it's inner television. But it's a bit the same stuff. But when you watch TV, you don't watch TV like this. You're like, I mean, in a way, we're constantly adjusting, making it more comfortable, you know, when it is a little rigorous, in a way, for the meditation at the beginning, because there is this, what is called effortless effort. The fact that we need to make an effort, but it needs to be not too intense, because then we become too tight. But at the same time, if we don't do anything, nothing will work. So in a way, we need to find with the body that effortless effort, with the mind that effortless effort, with the whole organism. And so to me, that picture is in a way what I would call each beginning of retreat. Even if you have done retreat before, it's always a little more to do it again, to put the body, to put the mind. And that's what generally there is, the first 2 days are a little difficult. In Korea, we used to sit for 3 months. And often, the people in Japan who only sit for a week, they would come to Korea. Because they thought, in a week's time, I get that much. If I do 3 months of it, a week multiplied by 12, then I will have 12 times that experience. And what they found, it was not like that at all. Instead of having difficulty for 2 days, you had difficulty for 2 weeks. Then the next 2 months were fantastic. You thought you were in the 2 months, in the middle of the 2 months, you had the feeling, I will do this forever. It's so good, I will do it forever. And then the last 2 weeks, you were ready to go every day. It was very interesting how the body, the whole organism adapt to the length of time. And so to me, in a way, this false picture is a bit that struggle we have maybe when we do the first retreat or maybe the first 2 days. And then you have the next picture, which is called tending the ox, tending the cow. And there, the little boy is holding the cow with the rope, but the rope is very loose. So he's just holding it very loosely. So now there is no more struggle. And I think this is when we become familiar with the practice. And in a way, we become more at ease with the practice, and in a way, we know what to do. I remember once I was, because we used to sit for 3 months, and then for 3 months it was free to travel. And I used to go and visit various masters. And so there was this master I went to visit. And so I had to take a bus, another bus, and then I had to walk an hour to get to his temple. So I got to his temple, and I bowed to him 3 times, as you do, and I said, Master, Master, tell me, how can I make my question vivid? And he just sat there. So finally he said, Master, Master. Then he looked at me and he said, you know already. That's all, 3 words. So I bowed and I left, and I thought, this is a bit short, huh? 3 words and all this, you know, the journeys, travel, that's all I got. This is a little small. And then I thought, but yeah, actually, I know what to do. I know what to do. The only thing I have to do is to do it. I don't have somebody to tell me how to make the questioning vivid. I know how to do it. I just have to do it myself. And to me, this fifth picture is when we start, in a way, little by little, to become our own teacher. We know how to try to focus the mind. We know how to try to be aware of the changing nature. We know about trying to cultivate more of this effortless effort. So then there is no struggle anymore, and it's just a cultivation. We just do it. But, and this is what is interesting, the boy is still holding the rope very gently. And to me, it shows that even at that stage, we still have to be careful. although we know how to see it, we know how to do the practice, still we could get into difficulty, and then we have to be careful. And so in a way, it's kind of when we kind of think, oh, now the meditation is working. And now you think, ah, now it should be working all the time exactly the same. And then you realize it is not so. That sometimes it really goes well. And sometimes suddenly for whatever reason, for a little while, it seems to not work so well. I remember once I was on a 3-month retreat and I was really keen. And so I was supposed to sit 10 hours a day, but I would sit 14 hours a day. I used to get up earlier and sit later and really try hard. And then suddenly in the middle of this, nothing. I tried to ask, what is this, this way, that way? And I would have so many thoughts and I would have so sleepy, nothing. Did not work for 2 weeks. But I could not leave because you stay there for 3 months. You don't really have the choice. So every day I tried, every day, nothing worked. And I kept at it. And then after 2 weeks, I heard a talk and suddenly I got it. And then the practice went by itself. Again, it became very easy, very smooth. So to see that, yes, at time, it will go well. But that doesn't mean that time to time, we might not have some difficulties. Then there is number 6. And number 6 is a lovely picture because it's called riding the cow back home. Then there is no rope. And the ox herder, the little boy, is playing the flute. And the cow goes by itself. And so this is a picture of great ease, of lightness, of freedom, of creativity and joy. I love this picture. And it's also of fluidity. In a way, we know the way. We don't have to even think, I have to meditate. We just do it. There is no expectation. We just do the meditation. We don't expect it to give us this or that. We just do it. There is this fluidity. And it reminds me of a moment when we were in Korea. There were not so many Westerners then at the time as monks and nuns. And so time to time, our embassies in the capital used to come and look at us. We were kind of a little exotic. So they used to come and check, you know, were we okay? What did we do? And so they used to come, and then a few of us would gather, you know, English, French, whatever. And then they would ask us, what do you do? And we'd say, well, you know, we sit 10 hours a day, da-da-da-da. We ask, what is it, da-da. And then they would look at us like, what? And then they would ask, why do you do this? So we look at each other, why do we do this? Look at each other. And then they looked at me, so I had to say something. And then I would say, we do it, just to do it. We really just to do it just for its own sake. And to me, this picture is about that. When we do the meditation really without any expectation, we just do it. It becomes actually so natural to do it, to just sit there, to just do it. And then you don't worry if you have thought or no thought or whatever, you just do it. You're really in the cultivation. You become the meditation itself. Then there is a next picture and it's called Forgetting the Cow, the Person Rests Alone. So the cow has gone. All this trouble to get it, to find it, and now it's not there anymore. And then you have a little hut and you have the moon and you have a little person just sitting there. And to me, this is when finally there is no separation between meditation and daily life, between what is spiritual and non-spiritual. And then it really becomes natural. It's just kind of like we don't force ourselves to be aware. We are aware. That it be driving, in the supermarket, listening, playing with children, whatever we do, we are aware. We do it with awareness. And then it can really just happen by itself. You don't have to all the time meditate. It's still good to go on retreat time to time, but we don't have to force ourselves. Because to me, this is what is important, that when you leave this retreat, you go to your daily life and then you bring the awareness with you. You do it as you sit in the bus or whatever happens, as you clean the toilet or whatever you do, to be aware of that. Not in that judging way, but more in the being in the moment, really flowing with your life. And to me, that's what this picture is about. To be naturally aware, to be wakeful, to resting in the moment. Then there is a next picture, number 8, and it's called the cow and the cow herder are both forgotten. So here they're both gone, all this work, and they're both gone. And instead, you have one of these famous Zen circles, you know, the black circle. And again, this is, it doesn't mean that literally we will become a circle, but it's that in a way, there we let go of our grip, we let go of the grasping, and in a way we experience emptiness, so that there is less I, me, mine, and we more weave the flow of condition. And also I think to me it's really when we start to see that we cannot reduce ourselves to just one single condition. We start to be more what I would call exploring, playing with the flow of condition. But at the same time, we have to be careful that emptiness does not mean that there is nothing. Because often that's what the way it's translated, shunyata, that there is nothing, or anatta, that there is nobody. But that's not the idea. It's more the fact that we don't grasp, so we don't add anything. And also we're more conscious of this fluidity, of this motion, of this interdependence, what we our survival depend on. And so that's why there, that picture, you have to be careful of a little this, because sometimes we experience this. When we sit in meditation, you might have an experience of emptiness or of oneness or of dissolution. Often I get people coming to me saying, I feel empty. And then they feel very worried. I say, but come on, you're still there, you know, you're not disappeared. But you feel different. I think it's very important to see this is an experience of de-grasping. So when you feel like either this emptiness or this oneness, of course you feel different. But you don't feel different because you jumped into something, but actually because what used to limit you, to kind of, often we create border, we create separation. So we feel like there is walls inside us. We feel very often quite rigid, quite solid, quite to protect ourselves. Often we have that feeling. And to me, when we feel the oneness or the openness or whatever we call it, is actually more that all these rigid things that we build up just disappear in that moment. So of course, we're going to experience ourselves very differently, so that we have more a feeling of fluidity, more of a feeling of spaciousness. But this is not the end of the path, because we still have two more pictures. And when I was in Korea, once we had these three monks who really wanted to practice hard. So as we do there, they went to a hermitage and they were practicing all day, all night. That's what you do there. And in the middle of that, one of them had this amazing experience of emptiness. So he rushed down the temple and he went to Master Kuzan and he said, "Master, Master, I experience emptiness, this is amazing, etc. You know, I am enlightened. And, you know, the path is ended." And so Master Kuzan took he had a big stick and he hit him. And the guy said, "Ah, you see, not everything is empty. You're still there." you know, it's a good experience, but you have to practice more. But he was not convinced because he was so sure it was so amazing, this emptiness. So he went to the next master. Next master did exactly the same thing. Then he went to the next one and the same thing. So finally he came back to practice more. So then the next two pictures. The next one is number 9 and it's called Returning to the Original Place. And this is a lovely picture of generally bamboo or flowers or trees. And in a way, it shows us one stage further in the practice, the interconnection, the interdependence, that there is, and we start to see there is no separation between the world and between ourselves, that actually we see that. That's what to me is so important, that the meditation is not separate, but actually the meditation is to help us to be more in the world. So of course when we come here, it looks like we're separate from the world, but in order to go back more connected to the world. And often our teacher, Master Kuzan, used to say, everything can be a Dharma talk. He used to say, look at this bird, he's teaching us a Dharma. Everything can become a Dharma teaching. So we start to look at the world in a different way, with more creativity. One example he used to give was of this orchid, that seemingly there is this amazing orchid in the mountain somewhere, and that the orchid has this amazing fragrance, but that the orchid does not worry to give the fragrance, that people are there or not, that people are not to say that she's such a great orchid to do this. She just spread her fragrance regardless if it's appreciated or not. It's just spreading, it's just giving. Which takes me to the last picture, which is called Appearing in the Marketplace. And there you have the little boy is back, and then with him is his big monk. Big monk with raggedy shoes and a little bag. And the idea is that after we've practiced, then actually we go back into the world. That we don't do this just for ourselves, but actually for the whole world. That actually it prepares us for this active, creative response. And also the fact that the monk has raggedy shoes is to see that we adapt to high and low. To me, this is this awakening, this kind of openness help us to really adapt, to really connect with what is going on. And so in that way, we have what I would say creative wise compassion for self and others. That actually, and that's why sometimes when we sit in meditation, I feel we have this experience when our heart opens. And in that moment, the way you could describe it is that you have no problem with nobody. In that moment, you are, in a way, you love the whole world. You are open to the whole world. And then from that experience, we go back into the world and we try to see how can I manifest wisdom and compassion in the world. But then not in whatever way in our condition. There is not a prescribed way of this creative wise compassion. So I like just to give you two examples. One was a nun I met in Thailand, and she was, you know, a nun, and she was kind of all white, and she looked very pure, and she looked like she was gliding when she walked. And one of the things she did, apart from helping disabled children, and she also helped unmarried mother, and she also helped Thai boxers. And Thai boxing is very, very aggressive. And so when she said Thai boxing, I thought, what? You know, you help Thai boxers? She said, well, they too are suffering. You know, they too are, you know, they need my compassion. Another example is this monk who he was born in a village, but he was a very bad boy, because after 16 he kept getting a girl of the village in having children and married. That was very bad. And so each time he had to give, his father used to have to give a bull, you know, in exchange for doing this thing. And so finally, you know, he kept behaving badly, so that they kind of thought, you know, we have to do something here. And so they send him to the monastery to become a monk, so it would be safe, girl would be safe. But they did not have much hope that he would be a great monk. They thought, let's see. And then he became a great monk, actually. He went to study and he practiced, and then he wanted to come back to help his village. And when he came back, he found that the village was very poor. And so he thought that what they needed was not meditation teaching or Dharma teaching. What they needed was actually little trucks, so that they could take their produce, their vegetable, to the market, because they had no means to do that. So he decided to go on an engineering course for 3 months. And then he came back and he started to build these little trucks, small thing, a bit like what you have created in the keyboard, this little different but a bit the same idea, in his temple. And a few people thought, wait a minute, monks don't build little trucks in the temple. That's not. But he thought, that's what he's needed to do first. I need to help them materially, and then I can help them spiritually, and then I can help them with the teaching. So in a way, there can be many different ways to help, to be a bodhisattva. I have a friend, she's also a Buddhist practitioner, she's a meditator and an artist. And for many years she organized meditation groups and things. And then her mother became very ill, and nobody else could take care of the mother. So for the last 2 years, she's totally dedicated her life to our mother, and with a very difficult brother. It's a very difficult situation. So I try to help as I can. But to me, that is compassion. That is creative compassion. Sometimes, yes, we can be compassionate very far away. But sometimes we also can be compassionate very close to us. And really, in a way, helping, because in that moment, that's the only thing that can be done. And so in terms of compassion, I would say one of the things to cultivate is listening. Listening so that we can really listen to the people and know what is it they want, what is it they need, and can I give it? Because there is also compassion for ourselves, compassion for our limits. So that's what I wanted to say tonight. And if there are any questions and comments, yeah?
Could you tell us a little bit about differences, if there are any essential differences in your Zen practice from the Theravada that kind of we mostly come from?
It's two different vocabulary. Once a Theravada monk came to our monastery, and he came to visit Master Cousin. Somebody else was translating. And when it was finished, I said, how it was? He said, oh, it was two different dictionaries talking to each other. Like a French dictionary talking to an Italian dictionary. And so, and this was my experience when I was in Korea, and there would be some people coming from the Vipassana tradition. And then they would talk to me about awareness. And then I would talk to them about questioning. And so at that level, I would say, at the level of the technique, it is a relatively different technique. But at the level of what you practice, it's the same. And to me, this is why I think it doesn't matter so much the technique, as long as you cultivate the samatha and the vipassana. Because I think the samatha and the vipassana, the concentration and the inquiry, you found in all Buddhist tradition, but in very different ways. So in the Vipassana tradition, the Theravada tradition, the idea is to focus on an object in the experience and then to notice its changing nature. That's the Samatha and Vipassana. in the Korean tradition, the samatha is to be focused on the question, and the vipassana is the fact that you question. So at the level of the technique is different, but at the level of the development of the concentration and inquiry, it seems to me you come to the same thing, that by developing quietness and clarity, stability and openness, then you develop creative awareness. And to me, that's why when I read the Vitaka Santana Sutta, because I did not know the Pali Canon for a long time, because in Korea we don't look at it. And somebody was teaching, when I was back in England, a friend of mine who was knew well the Sutta, and he gave us different courses, and one day he explained to us the Vitaka Santana Sutta. And then I thought, this is what I do! You know, having done meditation Zen style for 10 years, I do that. I do the 5 points. I realized that I was developing this creative awareness that the Theravada talk about, the awareness. So it's what it seems to me from that point on, that you have different technique, but if you cultivate samatha and vipassana together, you seems to develop a similar kind of awareness. And you seems to do the same thing in terms of dissolving the obstacle to the wisdom and compassion. Because there is another book I did, and this was a book on Buddhism and women. And so I went to interview 40 women of different types, Tibetan tradition, Zen tradition, Theravada tradition, lay women, nuns, so Easterner, Westerner. And after meeting very different practices, they all did very, very different practices. But in the end, when I met them, I felt they had developed the same thing, creative awareness, wisdom and compassion. So at the level of the technique, yes, it's very different. But at the level of what happens when you cultivate, I think you generally often, I think, develop the same awareness. That's what I would say. Okay, so thank you for listening. And I really hope that everybody will fully recuperate. Yes?
Karen was supposed to give an announcement, so I'll give instead of
that. Yeah, sure.
It's okay if I say in Hebrew?
Sure.
טוב, שלום למי שלא מכיר אותי, שמי אביב. מתוך הבירורים שלנו על איך להקל על על הקיבות של כולם פה, דיברנו עם האחות פה בקיבוץ, אז דבר אחד שהיא אמרה זה שזה יכול להיות שזה בכלל לא מהאוכל, יכול להיות שזה וירוס שמסתובב באוויר, ושבכל מקרה מי שמקיא דווקא צריך להיות מבסוט, כי אחרי שמקיאים אז פחות או יותר הבעיה נגמרת, אוקיי? והדבר היחיד שיכולה להמליץ עליו זה לשתות תה, מרווה ולימון, אז אני מקווה שהסיר שעמדנו על האש כבר רותח ותוכלו להגיע לשתות ויחכה בפינת תה. אוקיי, ושנשען טוב. ומי שלא מרגיש טוב, אז לא לאכול 12 שעות, או אם כן לאכול, אז ממש רק לחם או אורז, אבל להימנע מלאכול, להימנע מלשתות, רק לשתות מים.
Because not everybody is here, because some people had to leave, so they could be told.
We will take care of it.
Good. I think in a way at such time, I know we want to continue with the retreat, with the atmosphere of the retreat, but I think we can also have due compassion. So if you know somebody is in your room, is not very well, then we can all help each other at this difficult time. And I hope whatever you say was a remedy to whatever is happening, and that people hopefully recover fully soon. So we have now some walking meditation if you're able to do it, and then we meet again for those who are able to do it for the final sitting. And then I'll put this up, I think, maybe in the entrance to the kitchen, maybe, because the board is bigger than the one here.
The name of the painter. It's many different painters, based by different painters.
You see, there is. It's a very traditional way.
It's fantastic.
So you have the Japanese, the Chinese.
So
the Korean.
I cannot find it in any book, or.
Yeah. You can find it on the internet.
And in there, by what name? But what shall I put on the internet? Write it here.